Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining me on this rather unseasonably cool Thursday evening. And so today, the topic that I do want to talk about sounds very simple. What counts as climate solutions? However, the answer to this question is quite complex, as you'll see soon. Why this question matters is because it may determine where trillions of dollars of investments will flow over the next two decades. If we get it wrong, we could be at risk of funding activities that don't deliver the emission reductions that we need to reach net zero. So let's start with the very basic principle. As a society, if we want to reach net zero, we want to implement the goals of the 2015 Paris Agreement and manage the climate crisis, firms have some broad levers at their disposal. For the purposes of this lecture, the slides only talk about three of them. First, they can phase out of carbon-intensive assets and products, such as by closing coal power plants. They can phase into green assets and products, such as renewable energy. And for some sectors, the residual emissions they can't yet eliminate could potentially be offset through reforestation, for example. For the purposes of the lecture today, we will only be focusing on this phasing into green assets and products category, and I will be using the term green assets interchangeably with climate solutions. So, decarbonizing isn't just a corporate challenge. Banks channel the financing, investors allocate the capital, governments set the policy environment, regulators define the rules, and research centers like the TPI Center provide the independent analysis that hopefully holds everyone accountable. And all of these stakeholders need to work together to deliver net zero. So this increased uptake of green assets or climate solutions requires associated financing to scale by 2050. To put the scale of the challenge in perspective, to limit global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius, the average annual climate finance flows must increase nearly fivefold to around USD 8.8 trillion by 2050 per year. And investors will be central to mobilizing this capital, but only if they have clarity on what they're investing in. However, currently we do have a barrier to mobilizing capital for the transition, which is that there is a lack of shared understanding about what constitutes as a climate solution. So existing definitions of climate solutions currently draw on various boundaries. Some adopt a narrow approach and some adopt a broad approach. The narrow approach definitions only consider inherently low carbon assets as climate solutions, whereas broad definitions would allow investors to classify their investments into mitigation technologies and carbon removals with the aim of directing capital towards economy-wide decarbonization. And then there's a wide range of definitions that sit in between the broad and the narrow bucket. And these definitions often group supporting activities that allow the expansion of climate solutions alongside inherently low carbon solutions. When we look at the regulatory guidance available on what counts as climate solutions, we observe that currently over 30 states have established taxonomies. These can be seen as the shaded green countries on the world map on the screen. So taxonomies are official classifications of what counts as sustainable economic activity. The aim of these taxonomies is to offer a common language to steer investment towards net zero aligned and supporting activities. Hence, these can be used as a guidance to understand what could be classified as a climate solution. In addition to the national taxonomies, industry bodies such as the International Capital Market Association, or ICMA, have developed tools such as the ICMA Green Bond Principles to help define eligible green investments. And we'll hear more from Simone, hopefully during the panel discussion, about different bond labels and how they fit into this broader conversation. So amongst the space of various definitions out there, the one that the TPI Center is guided by when assessing climate solutions disclosures is that climate solutions should be technologies, activities, products, or assets that drive emission reductions in low carbon scenarios and that are inherently low carbon. In some definitional variations, they can be taken as products or assets that substitute high carbon assets or products. Enabling activities are other activities that are not necessarily purely low carbon, but are necessary to facilitate the deployment and expansion of climate solutions. Now, these could include mining and refining of critical minerals such as copper and nickel. For us at the center, distinguishing between pure climate solutions and climate enablers is important, as defining climate solutions too narrowly could prevent capital from flowing to activities essential to the transition. On the other hand, if we define climate solutions too broadly, it could lead to overstated climate benefits, weaker accountability in reporting, and potential greenwashing risks. And a clear distinction between climate solutions and enablers is thus essential to avoid the misallocation of capital. So against these guiding principles, the TPI Center measures climate solution disclosures across the corporates and banks through the Climate Action 100 Plus disclosure framework and the Net Zero Banking Assessment Framework. For corporates, we look at their disclosure on revenue and capital expenditure, or CapEx. And for banks, we take a different approach owing to their role in the transition, owing to their unique role in the transition, and we look at their disclosure on commitment, financing, and reporting. So what you can see on the screen is part of our results from our corporate assessments, and we have divided the data into sectors as decarbonization is inherently sector specific. In this graph, we look at 72 companies that are disclosing the specific actions, technologies, or operational changes they intend to deploy to reduce their emissions in line with their climate targets. This is essentially their decarbonization roadmap. These components of the roadmap have been categorized into five themes that you can see on the left to allow cross comparison across sectors. The data has been overlaid with the technology readiness levels from the International Energy Agency. These provide insight into the development stage of each technology and the associated risk. A high number indicates greater technology readiness and market uptake, whereas a lower value indicates the technology may still be in prototype stage. The size of each bubble here shows how commonly a given lever is referenced within each sector. Though this graph is quite rich, what I want to focus on is the significant variation in transition readiness across sectors and levers. At one end, airlines deploy technologies that have low readiness. Airlines are heavily reliant on sustainable aviation fuel, or SAF, as some call it in short, to reduce the majority of their emissions, and this is a technology that is not yet adopted in the market at scale. At the other end, we have electricity utilities, which are one of the most ready sectors. Companies in the electricity sector are disclosing commercially available technologies like solar and wind. These technologies can be seen as uncontested as climate solutions or inherently low carbon products. The broader picture is this, that in sectors where solutions are mature, the path to decarbonize is relatively clear. But in harder to abate industries, companies have to rely on technologies that are not yet proven at a commercial scale. So what I want you all to take away from this analysis is that variation in transition readiness of technologies across sectors and the levers deployed is something that investors need to consider when deciding where the money needs to flow. Finance for proven technologies and their expansion will look quite different to quite different from investments that fund research and development in hard to abate sectors. So here is where things get a bit concerning. Despite the importance of understanding how companies allocate capital to climate solutions, disclosure is still sparse in hard to abate sectors. This chart shows data for 164 companies in the Climate Action 100 Plus data set, showing disclosure of CapEx for both carbon intensive assets and the current and future climate solution investments for corporates. The disclosure rates are mixed across sectors and are particularly low in hard to abate sectors like cement and chemicals. And without information on CapEx, investors cannot assess whether transition plans are credible and well-funded. So we know that capital needs to scale, and banks are one of the most important channels for mobilizing this capital. Banks play a central role in financing the real economy through loans, credit facilities, and underwriting. They direct capital to companies and projects across every sector. What we see from our assessments is that roughly half of the banks have made an explicit commitment to scale up climate solution finance. Just to flag this, the sample for this data set is 36 banks. But once we move beyond the headline commitments and baseline reporting, the picture deteriorates. Only one out of 36 banks has quantified its climate solution targets using financial ratios, meaning all other banks cannot measure whether they're meeting their own commitments. Only one bank has defined climate solutions using an established external taxonomy, such as the EU taxonomy, meaning there is a lack of definition that is being applied to assess climate solutions by banks. And not a single bank has disclosed its total share of finance directed towards climate solutions. So we have banks making commitments, but not measuring them, and not even clearly defining what counts as an investment in climate solutions. There's a significant transparency gap, and the kind of gap that undermines investor confidence, as we often can't tell whether the money is actually driving the decarbonization that we need. So what should all of you take away from this? First, the scale of financing required is quite large. Closing this gap requires investors, companies, banks, and regulators to work from a shared understanding of what counts as a climate solution and to hold each other accountable. Secondly, there is currently a lack of common international standard around what constitutes as green investments, which creates real risks of inconsistency and comparability failures. Third, the distinction between climate solutions and climate enablers matters, as blurring this line risks misallocating capital and potentially enabling greenwashing. Lastly, corporate and bank disclosures on climate solutions remains sparse or inadequate. Investors do not currently have the information they need to assess the credibility of transition plans. So I believe now I have left you all with a lot of problems, but hopefully during the next segment of this lecture, we hope to hear from the industry experts on how they're tackling some of these issues to help ensure that the capital is flowing in the right direction. So over to you, Simon.
Thank you. you very much, Shafat, for the presentation and for setting the scene. So we'll now move into the panel discussion. So if I can ask my fellow panelists to come sit at the front and we'll get started. He's actually quite thin.
Too much to go on, Patrick.
Okay, we're all installed and we're not getting back out again. So, so thank you very much, Shafak. So we've described the problem, and our panelists are going to help us with solutions to this climate solutions problem. So we'll just start perhaps with you, Tessa. Perhaps you could share a bit about your role in the sustainable finance ecosystem and also on how climate solutions figure or don't figure in your day-to-day work.
Yeah, very happy to. I'm very glad to be here. Thanks for the invitation. I think when I first saw the title, I thought, I'm sure that we do look at climate solutions to invest in. So maybe explain a bit. You very kindly did my biography. CCLA is the largest fund manager for not-for-profit assets. And although we may invest in climate solutions, I'd say a small part of our portfolio will be in renewables or infrastructure or things that classically fall into that category. We don't sort of say, right, we're going to invest in a climate solution and that's where it'll be. It's more in terms of diversifying our portfolio. Where my role is, I'm in the sustainability team, and our largest asset class is listed equities. And although we do take carbon intensity into account a little bit in determining which companies to invest in the main we're looking what's going to be a good financial bet for our beneficiaries. And then we engage with the companies to decarbonize, and we're looking to the companies themselves to define what are climate solutions, and that's really what a lot of the discussions are about, you know, mapping that journey and how are you going to reach your targets.
Okay, thank you. Dan, perhaps can just go round the table. Same question to you. So tell us a bit more about your role in the ecosystem, and also tell us about how climate solutions come up in your work.
Sure. Thank you, and similarly, very happy to be invited, and thank you for that. So. Institutional Investor Group on Climate Change, another mouthful as far as an acronym is concerned. So we are a membership organisation for institutional investors that seek to want to understand climate-related risks, or climate and nature-related risks and opportunities, and ultimately address those risks and opportunities. And within that, my role as head of transition research is trying to develop and source tools to help them make those kind of assessments. And I'd say I'm particularly pleased to be sort of invited to talk about this topic, because climate solutions is a very important part of our work, and its importance is also increasing. So to put that in context, half of our roughly 400 institutional investor members have made or use one of our tools called the Net Zero Investment Framework, or NZIF, to manage their transition towards net zero. It's the most widely adopted tool at a portfolio level to manage transitions. NZIF asks investors to make sort of several kind of sort of governance and strategic kind of considerations in terms of managing risk. But probably one of the two areas that are, it also asks and sets ask investors to set objectives around managing their portfolio, and that the two objectives there. One is about decarbonising their portfolio to get to net zero, and the second one is increasing allocations towards climate solutions. And this dual structure of NZIF is really kind of important. It reflects the fundamental nature of the transition that Shafak was speaking to, that essentially you can't decarbonize without similarly scaling up the low carbon alternatives. And so our members kind of get that, they're bought into that concept and the structure of that. I must say that they have struggled a little bit with how to implement the setting of climate solutions targets, not least because of the definitional challenges that Shafak's outlined.
Okay, thank you, Dan. And Simone, same question to you. Tell us a bit more about your role and to the extent to which climate solutions come up in your work.
Yeah, thank you very much, and equally thank you for the invitation. It's a whole different, ground speaking to students, because you have to bear in mind there's not that much familiarity, I guess, with the subject matter. You've already introduced me, so maybe a little bit more on ICMA or ICMA. Indeed, we call it both, so don't be confused. We are a trade association with 620 members globally in 71 jurisdictions. We are organized across primary markets, secondary markets, repo and collateral. Now you're going to wonder where's sustainable finance. We have two cross-cutting themes. One is the one I sit in, sustainable finance. The other one is fintech and digitalization. Now, in my space, ICMA has been known mostly, I should say, for providing the secretariat for the principles, as they have become known. That's for green bond principles, social bond principles, sustainability linked, and very newly the climate transition bond guidelines, not principles. And we also provide a lot of guidance around that. We also have a code of conduct for ESG ratings and data product providers. That's more of a separate topic. I guess today is more relevant to talk about the sustainable bonds. I should say, and I mentioned that in our pre-call, we in our guidance don't really talk about climate solutions. Of course, I guess everything that we talk about could sort of fall under the term, but I think the terminology is more something used in the investor space. IIGCC uses it. We also, I'm aware of at least one end investor or asset owner, a big insurance company that works with us, is talking about climate solutions. But ICMA itself, we don't talk about climate solutions, but of course we, in the wider guidance, we cover what would fall under climate solutions.
Okay, thank you very much. And Shafak, I won't ask you what your opinion is because you've given it. So we'll do another round of questions. For the second round, what I'd like to ask the panellists to do is actually reflect on the presentation. You could feel free to comment on the position we've taken on how to define climate solutions, and also anything you found about the results of our analysis that was surprising, encouraging, or discouraging. So over to you first, Tess.
Thank you. So I think I took that to heart, and I was trying to find something surprising, something discouraging, and I thought I'd end on the encouraging, because there's a lot of discouraging in there to some extent. So I think what I was surprised by, and I'm thinking of the slide where you had all the green at the top with renewables, was I think we all understand renewables are now at parity with fossil fuels in terms of cost and deployment, and in some instances cheaper. So that's kind of market ready, market implemented. I was really surprised by everything else being, unless I've misinterpreted, being prototype or demonstration level. So that, no, but do answer, yeah.
I was just going to say it's about like where they are in terms of market uptake. So it was between 5 and 6 and 7 to 8, so not that bad, but there's still a long way to go for it to be fully commercially viable.
Yeah. No, that's helpful. I think commercially viable is the key point, isn't it? And if investors are being asked to put capital into something, that's often a big decision. I think there's a lot that's discouraging there. The chart you had of the different sectors and whether they're disclosing capex or not, and I think the point you made, I totally concur with, that the sectors that are hardest to decarbonise and have the most to do, aviation and cement, are doing very little. I think aviation wasn't disclosing of your choice of companies weren't disclosing any capex at all to these solutions. So I think we know in general, sort of across the board, worldwide, high impact companies, less than 50% are providing capital allocation. Outside Europe, it's less than 30%. So I think it was almost by doing it sector by sector, it made it even more stark. The sectors that need to do it aren't doing it. And the data from the banks was more stark than I realised. We do engage with banks through our counterparties in the main. And the very low use of financial ratios is something we ask about. If that's, again, if I'm understanding it right, we ask for the ratio of green versus brown. And we know very few companies are doing that, but it's a very useful ratio. And I think, again, from reading through it, that only represented one company, which is so, one bank, which is so poor. There's all these great headline proclamations of what they want to do, but when you dig further, there's very little happening. But to end on a positive note, what's encouraging? It was one sector, the electric utilities. It was the only one where their estimation of future capex was more than current, you know, what it currently is, you know, their allocation. So, you know, there are sectors and companies that are leading the way, and yeah, we can look to that.
Thank you. Dan, same question to you. What were your reactions to the presentation and the data?
I mean, I guess similar to a lot of things that Tessa's already shared, it's not a huge surprise about the inadequacy of transition plan disclosure in general. The Panks finding was I was similarly kind of impressed by how bad that was. That's not something I'd appreciated before. I mean, I would say that, you know, in general, the picture's probably not quite as gloomy at this current time. There's reasons to be optimistic in the sense that we've seen some really interesting data out from the likes of Ember about price parity of a lot of kind of clean tech solutions and the potential implications this has for particularly where the solutions are most needed in emerging markets. You now have kind of interest rate, which has been a major hurdle for these kind of upfront solutions. You now have, that's no longer a penalising factor in terms of, so, and then of course, you know, those have been ongoing, those price reductions, and you've seen those for the last 4 or 5 years, but that kind of reaching upfront parity is one thing. Then of course you've got the current energy crisis, and so we should see, I think, that manifest in some improvements in terms of allocations to capital to this space. But a kind of broader point that I wanted to make as well is I was very, you know, I'm encouraged to see the focus on this topic in general from Transition Pathway Initiative, like the, supporting our members analytically with a definition across multiple kind of asset classes, banks, corporates, and I would hope sovereigns at some point. I think is going to be a really important tool to some of the sort of objectives that I was talking about earlier with regards to NZIF, and you know, the availability of high quality data I think is you know, is going to be really helpful for our members sort of setting and assessing the credibility of corporates' commitments in this space.
Thank you. And Simone, what's your perspective on the information in the presentation?
Not that much to add. I was, however, thinking when I saw the chart with all the hard-to-abate sectors listed, I thought shipping was missing. I didn't see shipping on there.
It's because within the data set, we just had one company on shipping currently, okay. So we excluded it.
Okay. But just for everyone to know, shipping is a big sector, hard to abate as well. Also, maybe for those who are not that familiar with the subject matter, why do we look at hard to abate sectors? What does that mean? Because I think in recent years, we've talked a lot about transition, right? But what we really meant was the energy transition or green transition, wherein we invest in renewables. For example, we've also, with green bonds, you've seen a lot of investments in, yes, renewables, but also energy efficiency, green buildings, transportation, and so on. And that is often an easy investment in a way, right? We also have in the COP28 text in Dubai, we need to transition away from fossil fuel. And that is easy for some, where you can replace the fossil fuel with renewables. Solar, wind energy, for example, but the hard-to-abate sectors are the ones that cannot just transition away, right? They really need to invest in technology, for example, to help them transition, and those are the sectors we still need in the future, so we can't just ignore them, so we need to help them raise finance. So that's really why we're talking about this, and yeah, otherwise not really much more to add to the presentation itself.
Okay, thank you. Tessa, coming back to you, you're involved in engaging companies on climate change, as I understand. So as far as the more advanced companies are concerned, What are you seeing from them in terms of identifying and defining climate solutions and disclosing the capital expenditure they plan to make into them?
I might turn the question on its head and say what companies that aren't good at it, and then why, how we try and engage with them
to get to
a better stage, which will, I hope will end up answering your question. But I was thinking of an American, I might as well say it because there's nothing confidential about it. We were engaging with Home Depot a couple of years ago, and they've talked about their past emissions, they had targets, they talked about various initiatives. But it was really difficult to get to a sense of how they were going to reach those targets and get there. And so that's really what we want, a more coherent transition plan for them. So one of the things we asked for, and I call it a visual roadmap, saying, you're here now, this is your target in 2030. What are the mechanisms? What are you going to use to get there? And how much is it going to give you those carbon emission reductions? And you might even term those climate solutions. That's how they're going to get to their target. And there was a lot of pushback and, oh, we can't, it's, you know, commercially sensitive, or, you know, different considerations. So I had no high expectations. And then we went back a year later, and I was really astonished to see. It's a very simple diagram, but it kind of cuts through the greenwash, and it's called a waterfall chart. And they'd done it. They'd done it for Scope 1 and 2, direct emissions, and for Scope 3. And for Scope 1, it was renewables, energy efficiency for gas, energy efficiency for electricity, and greening the grid. And that was it. Through that, they'd hit their targets. But that was their climate solutions. I found the Scope 3 one particularly interesting. It was renewables, greening the grid, addressing their products, so electrifying all their products, you know, sort of garden implements or whatever else. And then the biggest section was gap to ambition. So I just thought, that's truthful. A lot of companies don't know what the climate solutions are. And I thought they were so not wanting to put their transition plan out there. And then they did. And the biggest bit was, we don't know how we're going to do it. So really, to answer your question, it's more we're helping companies to progress, to do that thinking of what their solutions are and how they can tell shareholders in an understandable way that they've really done this thinking. So the companies that are doing it well, for example, we've engaged with Unilever for quite some time. They do the same kind of mapping. It's called a waterfall chart. They have about 9 different climate solutions, and you can see their thinking's much more advanced, and they know which proportion of their emission reductions are going to come from that. They still have something called an innovation gap, which is only about 20% of their emissions. But I think, as we've seen from the data, linking this to capital allocation is still very sparse, and neither of those companies are particularly good at doing that.
Have you ever seen a waterfall chart that doesn't have a gap?
Yes, I think so. But I can't think immediately what it's
okay.
about.
That's
a good question.
Good
I'll have to go and
good
do my research.
Yeah,
and
yeah. Dan, moving to you, we understand that IIGCC is also working on its own practical definition of what constitutes a climate solution. Could you talk a little bit about how you're defining it, and also how your definition is positioned relative to the existing landscape?
Yeah, sure. And it's nice to get that waterfall, a shout out for the waterfall chart.
Well,
I think that's something we were looking at when we were back in 2019 and looking at oil and gas companies. So we've been working with our members to develop a definition of climate solutions. And it's, again, speaking to that NZIF twin pillar of phase down, out, fossil fuel, ramp up, climate solutions. And so it's really important to have a robust definition of what they are. And that definition is essentially activities, technologies, assets that need to grow substantially according to credible pathways to reach a net zero destination. And I wanted to kind of unpick some elements of that, because it kind of, we're hoping that it's a more sort of robust approach to sort of delineating what's in the bucket and what's out the bucket. So explicitly focusing on activities that need to grow rather than looking at emissions reductions per se. This is something that the industry has kind of inherited from GFANS, and it's also kind of been part of taxonomy type approaches to say that a climate solution is something that is less emissions intensive than the existing activity. And unfortunately, if you start thinking about that through, you end up in some quite problematic spaces, and you know, gas being included in taxonomies, coal in certain circumstances being included in taxonomies, that is not going to get us to net zero. So there's a need to kind of focus on the end state. What do we need in the end state, and activities that are inherently compatible with that? And so that second element is inherent compatibility. You're looking at activities that have emissions thresholds that are capable of being aligned in a 2050 scenario, for 2050 net zero scenario. So this scenario, this kind of approach to climate solutions that we have within IAGC, we're hoping is a more robust kind of way to take things forward. It does include both the enabling activities or enabling solutions, as Shafaka said, and also kind of the regular climate solutions that you were talking about. And so our focus has been over the last 6 months is taking that kind of generic high-level definition and mapping that onto existing modelling climate economy models to show how that works in practice. You know, many of our investors will be kind of implementing it in their own way, but we're sort of helping out by showing that how that can be done. And then we're talking about how do you assess climate solutions at a corporate level? How do you then engage on those? So those are the topics that are upcoming in our work.
Okay, thank you. Simone, coming back to you, and perhaps broadening it, the discussion a bit away from climate solutions and thinking about wider climate finance, could you talk to us a bit about how different types of bond can mobilise investments into the transition?
Yeah, sure. So different types of bonds. I don't know how familiar each of you is with labelled bonds. We have the Secretariat, as I said, for labelled bonds. So green bonds are an obvious source or an obvious instrument that can lead the capital flows towards the transition. Bit confusing sometimes for people when they hear green bonds are financing transition. What you really should understand green as is these are bonds that are contributing towards environmental objectives such as climate change mitigation, climate change adaptation, for example. And I think thinking of it in those terms makes it much more obvious that those are instruments that can help with the transition. So I've already mentioned some more obvious green projects earlier on, renewable energy and energy efficiency and so on. Of course, as part of the green transition theme, you could also finance those. It's really sometimes up to the issuer how they perhaps phrase this, and that's where the entity level strategy comes in, right? So what investors are really looking at is, do they have a strategy that financing instrument fits with? Ideally, of course, they would also have a transition plan where you can see the CapEx, you know, so fully costed and really to give a holistic picture to see why are they raising this finance. Now, that being said, there were still some issuers, especially in those hard-to-abate sectors that we keep talking about, that were a bit afraid of being accused of greenwashing when raising finance through a green bond. So hopefully the new guidelines that we came out with last year in November, the climate transition bond guidelines on issuance level, they will help with that. We still have guidance on entity level, which is the Climate Transition Finance Handbook, which is basically a set of four key elements which entail disclosure recommendations, again, to have a strategy, for example, to be science-based, to explain the implementation and so on. So those really go together. But with the Climate Transition Bond Guidelines, you now have a lot more in there that issuers have to align with. I should also mention other guidance that we have. We have sustainability-linked bond principles, so that is another type of instrument, whereas green bonds are a use of proceeds instrument, as we call it, because we look at what's being financed. With sustainability-linked bonds, or SLBs, the focus is really on the strategy of the issuer. So those are so-called general purpose instruments. So they don't have to be used for the transition. They can also be used for other things, but really they're most widely used to underline a transition strategy. Issuers would then mention a KPI. So, for example, we want to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. That would be calibrated to a sustainability performance target. So by how much would they reduce them and by what year and so on. And if they don't achieve that, there's a structural element, right? So there might be a coupon step up or something. But anyway, just to say that is another instrument that you can use. We've seen in Shafak's presentation, climate enabling, I think you called it. We call it green enabling. So we have guidance for green enabling projects. And those are projects that are not green in themselves, but rather projects that you could find along the value chain, for example. So also coming back to your example, those could be that could be the mining of certain minerals, like lithium for batteries, for electronic vehicles, for example. So really things that go together with a green project but are not green in themselves. And then, of course, if you wanted to, you could also issue a social bond to specifically finance maybe the just transition and so on. So really a lot of different instruments, and it depends on the issuer, you know, what kind of instrument they want to use. If they want to issue in labeled form, I should maybe close and saying, of course, you can still issue an unlabeled conventional bond, for example, but really the additionality that a labeled bond brings, again, and investors really like that, is the transparency, because with a labeled bond, you follow the ICMA principles, you follow the core components in the principles, which means you tell your investor community how is the money being allocated, what impact is being achieved, what are you financing, and so on, and you wouldn't have that with a conventional bond.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Thank you. So, if I can just go off-piste for a second. So, how big a deal are these various kinds of green and sustainability-linked bonds? I mean, just broadly speaking, what kind of share of the debt market are they taking up at the moment?
So, compared to the overall debt market, they're still, of course, smaller, but they have really grown since the principles came out. I mean, we've seen the first green bond in 2008 from the World Bank. We've also seen the EIB issue a climate bond around that time, 2007. But really, the market took off when the green bond principles came out, when ICMA became the secretariat, which was 2014. In the following years, we then came out with the other principles. Today, we have about $7 trillion of bonds outstanding. Green bonds are still take the lion's share when you look at green, social, sustainability-linked bond and so on issuance. So green bonds are still the ones that are used most widely. You can also have sustainability bonds, not to be confused with sustainability-linked. Sustainability bonds are also a use of proceeds type of instrument, which brings together a mix of green and social projects. So $7 trillion, still really good, and really in the last 2 years or so, every year it has grown by a trillion. So pretty good growth,
really,
and also still a success story, right? Especially with all the bad news that we're being confronted with these days, the sustainable bonds market is still growing.
Thank really a useful context. Thank you, Simone. So, Tessa, coming back to climate solutions, what are the biggest challenges that companies and investors face when assessing whether climate solutions are backed by credible capital allocation?
So I think we'd have to separate it into two, what the challenges for companies are,
yes,
and what the challenges,
yes,
for investors are. So I think the challenges for companies, as I've already illustrated, is in fact defining what are the activities that support transition. So I gave a very simple example of one company, but there are other disclosures that are really helpful. So when we're speaking to companies If they've used the CSRD Corporate Sustainability Reportive Directive guidance, we're seeing much more useful information coming from companies. Those who have to report against a taxonomy, I'm most familiar with the companies that have used the EU taxonomy, mm-hmm. we're starting to see much more useful information. The companies themselves may beg to differ, but compared to a few years ago when you're getting nothing from them, even if they don't think it captures, you know, the relevant necessarily metrics for them, it's still a start. We still like to see, you know, numbers being attached to their activities.
So if I sort of just jump in for a second, so is that telling us something about the value of mandatory reporting in this space?
I would say absolutely. Mm-hmm. And when I go, I think we're aware there's a sort of backlash against a lot of mandated reporting and taxonomies. We've had the EU omnibus measures from the US to kind of diminish a lot of this kind of reporting. And whenever I meet with companies and they have done this type of reporting, and it is very detailed, and I can see why there's pushback against it, but it's hugely valuable. You know, when you look at their reporting from 3 years ago to now, you're getting information that's comparable, you're getting information that's quantified, you're getting just so much more understanding of their business model. So, yes. I was just thinking, so there's a sort of, I wouldn't say narrow reporting, but there's a certain kind of reporting that taxonomies cover, certain activities, but there will be other areas where companies have defined these areas as solutions to enable them to reach their climate targets that don't neatly fall into that. One, for example, I would say is in terms of if companies are saying we need greening of the grid, how is one company going to do that? Well, they need to have policy approaches to things, they need to be involved in lobbying. So what resources are they putting to that? So there's some very intangible kind of elements in terms of capital allocation, resource allocation. And, you know, things, we speak to companies who are funding initiatives, for example, food and drinks companies in their agricultural supply chain, again, that might not be covered by a strict taxonomy, but are really helping to lead to those emission reductions. And then I would say the challenges for investors, and that's why I was particularly interested in the bank slide and of the sort of green and brown ratio, you know, that so few companies are doing, so few banks are providing that, but it is something we ask for in engagement. But again, that companies have these overall principles of wanting to fund climate solutions and doing a bit of disclosure on how they're going to do that and maybe setting targets. But in a recent conversation we had with a bank, when it comes to the actual decisions, when they're deciding whether to give a client or somebody approaching the bank money, we were told, and this just sort of came out, it wasn't even a question, they said, well, we rely on our internal judgment and it really depends on the relationship manager's discretion with that client or the company looking for funding. So I thought, there's that disconnect, isn't there? There's not that governance following through. And we've got these overall targets, but we're not necessarily seeing them. You know, there's challenges for us as investors in making sure there are the mechanisms to do so.
Yes, and I think an implementation gap is something that we frequently see in various aspects of our work. So, Dan, same question to you. So what are the biggest challenges here in terms of, and thinking about both companies and investors?
Yes, I would echo a lot of what Tess has just said. The taxonomy point is a really good one. I've not only just started, there's been obviously a lot of corporate pushback about this disclosure, and but when you actually get into to look at it and use it as I have over the last few months, it's really, really helpful having that level of granularity. There are caveats to that, but in general, very helpful. I think the definitional challenge, and hopefully we're making progress on that. I think that has been a big major obstacle. But when it comes to assessing corporates, I see it very much a kind of multi-criteria type of approach, almost like a parallel but smaller scale to on the decarbonisation side, where if you think about a company's capital investment cycle, they put CapEx in. You want to see some evidence of the outputs of that, both kind of operational performance, and then you want to see revenues, and then ultimately as an investor, you want to see profits. And that and that capital then potentially, hopefully, gets recycled back into further growth. So in order to kind of effectively measure what a, you know, what is a climate solution contribution, I think you need to take stages at both part, you know, both the input side, which is on the capital investment side, and on the output side. A company just investing capital is not necessarily indicative of, could be indicative of a company wasting money. So you want to be able to judge the two things in parallel. And the final thing I would add here is operational metrics, really important. So being able to see where that capital is going to, most of the kind of key climate solutions activities actually lead to real economy outputs that both companies are setting targets on and are outputs of climate economy models. So you can actually benchmark to some degree what good looks like by kind of comparing growth and different aspects against that. So those are some of the parameters that we're thinking about. And obviously, ultimately, we want to use that as a kind of tool to drive engagement activities, but also help investors set and or communicate their allocations to this space.
Thank you. Shafak, if I can bring you back in now, you've obviously, you and the team have spent many happy hours poring over corporate climate disclosures. So what are the biggest gaps that you're seeing today in how climate solutions are being defined and measured by companies?
So the biggest gap that I do see is the definitional uncertainty. And I think one thing that I probably should have mentioned earlier is that when we look at these national taxonomies, right, there's a lot of discrepancy even within them. For example, the EU taxonomy does not allow coal under sustainable economic activities at all. However, the Chinese and Indonesian taxonomies do allow coal under certain thresholds, right? So, and then there's some taxonomies that provide like a quite detailed list of sector by sector guidance and list of activities, and then there are others which are very high level and don't really go into the detail of what any of it means for a user. And what this does is that it trickles down into a company trying to understand what a climate solution would mean for them. And I'm also going to talk about like a retail company. It could be Home Depot, or it could just be someone who just sells food. And for us, it's genuinely unclear of what would count as a potential climate solution for such companies. And we do get approached by companies and investors that what would climate solutions mean for these companies and what do we think about it when we look at them. And to answer their questions, when we try to look at existing guidances out there, the picture is quite inconsistent. For example, if you look at certain green revenue classification systems, they would talk about alternative packaging, sustainable packaging, or plant-based products for these companies. But then the question that comes to mind is, does this really reduce their emissions by like a large margin? Maybe not. And are they genuinely climate solutions under like a rigorous definition of climate solutions? That's also something that is quite unclear at the moment. So simply put, like in companies which are easier to abate, okay, not easier to abate, but where the technologies are quite proven, like for example, electricity, our autos company, it's quite simple and straightforward, but then in hard to abate sectors or just sectors which aren't really directly producing these products, there is a confusion of how and what good climate solutions for them be. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to ask the panel a couple more questions, but then I'm going to turn over to Q&A, so get your questions ready. So Tessa, just coming back to you, and thinking about the metrics, so in your view as an investor, what core metrics do investors need most from companies?
Well, again, I think I'm probably going to flip the question around, but it's almost the frameworks we use to, when we're looking at companies, so we are looking for certain metrics. And I would say, for us, we actually do heavily rely on the TPI scorings, because as it, in the same way we're asking companies to prove they're progressing, we as investors also have to prove that our engagement has effect. So we use the TPI scorings as an initial approach when we start engaging with a company.
We didn't pre-agree that answer.
And then at the end of the year, we see if they've progressed either within there's sort of five bands and there's 24 metrics altogether within a band or, moved up one. So one of the ones we particularly focus on is, does the company align future capital expenditures with its long-term decarbonisation goals and disclose how the alignment is determined? And not many companies that we invest in get a yes for that, but it starts the kind of conversations we need to be having with them, so it's very useful. I've talked about waterfall charts, so I won't do that one to death again. But it's not a metric, but again, I just feel like it cuts through the greenwashing. You can really see if they've got their thinking there or not. And then I wanted to talk also about a mechanism, which is that when you've got companies who really have thought through their business strategy, thought how they're going to reach their decarbonisation targets, have a clear transition plan, but it might require quite a lot of capital allocation, and they've defined it, we are very encouraging of them going to shareholders and themselves putting a resolution saying, this is our transition plan, what do you think of it, and do you approve it? And we started with a group of other investors about 5 years ago. Unilever was the first company to do that. Now 20% of the FTSE 100 have done it. And it's not quite a metric, but if you've got all the metrics there, and you've defined your plan, you've defined the capital allocation, then you want shareholder buy-in of your strategy. We think that's a really good way of doing it.
Great, thank you. And sort of last question, perhaps, to you, Simone. So talking about mechanisms, that was one of the last things that Tessa mentioned. ICMA recently published guidelines on transition bonds. Can you reflect on how transition bonds could contribute to financing climate solutions?
Yeah, so I already talked a bit about how green bonds and sustainability-linked bonds can be used. Now we have climate transition bonds, and really what they do, hopefully, as I said earlier, they're going to help with that fear of being accused of greenwashing by raising finance with a green transition-themed bond. Because what they entail, in addition to the core components, same four core components that we have in the green bond principles, for example. Additionally, we have safeguards in there. So issuers should really meet or explain how they're going to meet certain safeguards. First of all, again, they should have a strategy that everything fits with, ideally also a transition plan. They should explain explain in a way why carbon alternatives are technologically or economically unfeasible. They should also look to taxonomies, and coming back to what Shafak just said, of course taxonomies at the moment, yes, they're very different. You said there are 30 taxonomies or even 60 when you look at what's currently being in process. There's really a proliferation of taxonomies because every jurisdiction looks to their own regional challenges, and that's why we have these differences. Also, some taxonomies are, they're a bit more, they cater a bit more to financing the transition in that they have a traffic light system. So the ASEAN taxonomy, the Singapore taxonomy, and so on, they would have amber categories, not just binary like the EU taxonomy, green or not green, although the EU also has transition activities and they're working on it a little bit more. So that is another safeguard. If you as an issuer are using transition pathways or taxonomies, just explain that as well. You should also explain how you're mitigating greenhouse gas emissions beyond business as usual. And very importantly, you should also explain how you're avoiding carbon lock-in. So these are all safeguards. These are five safeguards for hard-to-abate sectors. And then there are additional safeguards if you're financing fossil fuel-related infrastructure or activities, where you would also be expected to have a transition plan on asset level and so on. So really, those are additional things that we added to the climate transition bond guidelines, and then we also give examples a non-exhaustive list. We started with five categories as to what could be financed, and it's really now, it's early days. We've published this in November last year, and we've seen one deal so far. Well, you might not even have seen that, because that was a private placement from a bank with the IFC. And otherwise, we have three banks that came out with transition frameworks that align with the new guidelines, but we haven't seen any more deals, and we haven't seen any corporate yet. So I'm expecting this to come. Might also be, you know, I would have expected maybe something to see from the Middle East. We've seen one of the banks was a Riyadh bank, but otherwise there might have been more if it wasn't for the current geopolitical situation, maybe. But I'm expecting there, you know, more to come, and for us more to see, and hopefully the first corporate soon as well.
Let's hope so. Well, thank you to the panel for your contributions to the panel segment. So we can now move into the Q&A. We've got plenty of time for questions from the audience, both in the theatre and online. I'll start with a round of questions in the theatre, and then I'll ask Ali if we've got any questions online. For those of you in the room, please raise your hand. I'll pick you out. Please wait for the microphone to come. If possible, please briefly introduce yourselves before asking your question, and do try to make it a question rather than a comment or a speech. So we've got a question at the back. So if you just wait for the microphone, and we look forward to your question.
Thank you. Elodie Muchamblé, I'm a sustainability manager, ex-McKinsey, ex-GFENS. I want to ask a question on bonds. I wonder if the sustainability-linked bonds can be used by smaller companies, so typically the targets for the private equity funds. Like, do you typically see smaller ticket sizes, or is it too much effort for those companies? I can see some of my clients who would benefit from it, like tying KPIs to get an investment as to motivate the PE firms, but I don't know if it's accessible for them. So would love to know if you know there's some deals like that. Thanks.
Okay, we'll see if there are another couple of questions. We'll take them in a set. So in the middle here, the second question. That's it, thank you.
Hi, my name's Lucinda. I work in a responsible investment team at an asset owner. And my question was about, on the taxonomies, you mentioned that there was a lot of discrepancy between national taxonomies. So I just wondered what you thought was the best way to overcome that as either a company or an investor, and how to manage the discrepancies.
Okay, thank you very much. I'll take one more question. So, towards the front here in the middle. I'm making your life difficult by picking people in the middle, but you can manage.
Thank you. I'm a student of economic policy at SOAS. I wanted to get a perspective of what you guys think on what the role of government policy should be in terms of this investable transition, and how is the government or how the corporate sector or stakeholders taking into account the transition risk that comes along with this entire transition, where a lot of these companies and sort of markets will lose value in terms of assets. So I just, that was one question.
Okay, thank you. So we'll try to provide some answers to your questions now. Three great questions. I'll have an initial go at allocating them, but you can tell me whether you know, all of you feel free to chip in. So the question about sustainability-linked bonds and small companies, Simone, that seems like a question right up your alley. So,
yeah, so in general, about deal size, yeah, you need about, I think, 500 million to be index eligible, and then investors, you know, especially if you're an end investor like a pension fund or so on, they would look at 1 billion to invest in. That's not to say that there couldn't be smaller ticket items. We see that more in the social bond space, for example, where you could have, I've seen 12 million and so on for gender bonds, for example. For SLBs in general, I mean, I should say in general, the principles that we have, they are not tailored to, you know, can they be used by SMEs, or equally a question we sometimes get, do you have specific principles for emerging markets, for example? They're not tailored to certain regions or certain company sizes. they can theoretically be used, yes, but it would really be up to the issuer to see if that works for them. I don't know if that answers your question, but yeah, there's nothing tailored really for SMEs. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Dan, would you like to tackle the taxonomy discrepancies question? Is variation good or bad, and what do we do about it?
So I think I like the way Simone phrased it earlier. So each taxonomy reflects the kind of national interests of its author, essentially. And so you end up with a kind of mosaic of overlapping and generally stuff that's designed to be helpful, but actually, if you're a global investor trying to put the pieces together, is actually very difficult. And one of the things that's also unhelpful about taxonomy is type approach, is that you tend to have hundreds of different items. And when you actually, as an investor, and if you look at where the capital needs to go to in terms of transition, it's a basket of about seven or eight, a dozen items that we really need to ramp up. And actually, probably four of them are the things that really matter. And so it's not an ideal starting point in terms of the, but we have to kind of live and deal with those with that situation. So the guidance that we have for our members in this area is a kind of what's called a taxonomy plus approach, where you sort of take what you like from each. You recognise that there is data, you're only going to get data through that taxonomy, but you set your own parameters as an individual investor as to what you think is acceptable, and you source and data that fits those parameters from as best you can from that. And there's going to be issues with that approach, but it's probably the best that we have at the moment.
Shafak, did you want to come in also on that question?
Yeah, I'm just going to quickly add that at a state level, there are some things happening, such as the common ground taxonomy. So there are efforts being done which are trying to understand the commonalities and differences between all of these taxonomies. So yeah, that's a start, but at least they recognize that there are differences. And like Dan already said, that there are like policy and regional contexts that are taken into account when producing these taxonomies. So yeah, there's a first step, but let's see how those steps further evolve in the future.
Yeah, and also just to add, a lot of taxonomies are actually based on the EU taxonomy, because that was one of the first. The very first was the China Green Bonds Project endorsed catalog, but the first one with really technical screening criteria and so on, that was the EU. So for example, in ASEAN with the traffic light system, the green aligns to the EU taxonomy, but then you have these additional amber categories and red, it's really not. Not part then. They also have, for the amber category, they have sunset dates, they call it, as to when that needs to be reached and so on. That's why I said earlier some taxonomies cater better to the transition element. But really, I would say in general, also if you're an issuer in that region, you would first of all look to your local taxonomy. And then, of course, if you want to attract international investors, then maybe you would put in other elements as well. But that's really, I don't see such a big problem. It is a bit of a challenge with the common ground taxonomy at the moment. That sounds really good, and that sounds like it's a taxonomy. It's not a taxonomy. It's more sort of it's a collaboration at the moment, I think, between the EU, China, Singapore, I think, is in there as well. Where they look at, yes, common ground, as it says, but not to come out with another taxonomy, but really just to point out which elements are similar. But there's still so many elements that you can't even compare. So, so I'm not even sure where that is at the moment. I haven't really heard anything about it in a while. So.
Okay. Tessa, if I can put the government policy question to you. So as an investor, how do you see the role of government policy in this area?
So my role at CCLA is to engage with companies on our portfolios on climate and biodiversity. And it's very sort of equity company directed, but again and again, we come across so many of these systemic issues can only be addressed at sort of policy and at governmental level. So that's why I've got involved with the IIGCC UK Policy Working Group. And again, just to go back to the example of Home Depot and other companies as well, especially in their Scope 3 emissions, or even if in their Scope 1 and 2 emissions, greening the grid is one element that they're going to have to get to their emission reductions. How are they going to tackle that? It's only through government policy and regulation and, you know, the activities they can take to influence that. And I think when there is policy changes, I mean, I think a recent one has been really interesting moves to separate electricity pricing from being underpinned by gas pricing. I think that's going to have a huge difference, and I think it will affect the pace and scale of the transition.
Thank you. Yeah. I was going to say, in a good way or a bad way?
Oh, in a good way, yes. So to shorten the time frame, I think, is what I'd say. And there was another element of the question about risk, but I'm not sure.
Well, I think in the interest of time, we should probably go to the online questions. So my colleague Ali has been dutifully monitoring the online questions. Ali, do we have two or three questions that we can put to the panel?
You indeed.
We'll get you a microphone first.
So a question from Antonio. Why don't investors push for adequate ESG disclosures as they do for accounting principles? The second question is anonymous user, a question for Tessa. How do you engage with companies who do not disclose their transition plans, or worse, who don't seem to consider climate crisis? And a final one for Dan, again, anonymous user. There are certain research reports that show that investor engagements do not make much difference in the net zero transition. What would you say to that? Sorry, Dan.
Okay, so the people asking the questions are doing my job for me and allocating them. We'll perhaps go to the second question, because that was for you, Tessa. So this is about, what to do with companies that are not disclosing adequate transition plans, if I remember the question.
And I think it was even more that they almost don't consider climate an issue or address it. So our portfolio is roughly 100 companies. We do take climate intensity into account, as I said, when we choose to invest in companies, although in the main it's a financial bet. It's a financial determination. You know, we're looking for long-term value for our beneficiaries and clients. So we don't have any companies who won't address it at all. We just have a lot of companies who know, they know it's an issue, they know they've got to do something about it, but they're really struggling how to do it. And that's when a lot of these measures like taxonomies are useful, but almost it's almost too complex for them. They have to go through that first stage of recognising where they're going to make their emission reductions from, and I think just having the conversation, really, just saying we're investors, we consider it matters. Our AUM is only 15 billion, which for an asset manager isn't a lot, but we work in collaboration with other investors through IIGCC, there's a Net Zero Engagement Initiative, Climate Action 100. And then you're talking about trillions in assets under management. So that, but then when you're having conversations with companies, they realise it's a mainstream investor issue, and they really need to do something about it.
Thank you. Dan, I think you were being asked to offer your perspective on whether engagement is working or not.
That's the million-dollar question, perhaps even more than that. But there are studies that say that. There are studies that say engagement works in certain circumstances, and we've conducted and there's been several academic studies that have been undertaken on the CA100, and not least by people within the LSE, but also the Wharton School, to sort of assessing the impact that engagement has. And obviously that's a large part of the tools and the assessments that we provide support that engagement need. There's a very asymmetric kind of profile in terms of the amount of effort and the reward that gets allocated to you if you even are successful. There's a huge amount of effort to go into these engagements. They need a consistent policy background towards it, and investors have to have scarce resources about where and where to when and where to allocate that. And if the policy environment's not, or the economic environment's not, it's not always possible for engagement to overcome those obstacles, I would say. But there are evidence of success. I don't think, and again, there are studies that would say this, I don't think we would have had the top five largest oil and gas companies setting net zero targets without investor engagement, for example. I won't think we would have mining companies divesting coal to the extent that they did and the pace that they did. Now, what I'm looking forward to, hopefully, is that in the current environment, the momentum swings that we, the pendulum is beginning to swing the other way, and such that we get, certainly in Europe, a more ambitious policy. We have an ambitious policy framework, and I think that the economics are increasingly stacking up on the right side as well. So, a kind of complicated answer, but you get a sense of, in certain circumstances, I believe it is effective.
Thank you. Simone, did you want to offer any thoughts on any of the three questions? So I think the first question was about investor ESG disclosure, but either of the other questions as well.
Investor ESG disclosure? I thought it was
Maybe Ali can reread the question.
Why do investors push for?
So that would be corporate disclosure. So I would say, we've seen that in the EU, right, where you've had the European Sustainability Reporting Standards, the ESRS, being capped in a way as part of the wider omnibus initiative. Under the corporate sustainability disclosure regulation, that was something where corporates were being asked to disclose certain things or to report certain things. And I think rightly so, because we don't have to disclose a million things. We need to disclose the relevant things, right? So in that matter, it's not the quantity, it's more the quality of what is being disclosed. And also we shouldn't get too hung up on disclosures in general, because they're not going to get us anywhere. The disclosures themselves, just knowing about something doesn't help us with real economy progress. The implementation is much more important. So I wouldn't get too hung up on too many disclosure points. That's more for reporting maybe, and yes, in turn, if investors are being asked to report as well. So everything obviously has to go together. And maybe that's where we come back to policy as well. And I fully agree with what was just said on engagement. As Dan said, yes, of course, engagement can only get you so far if you then reach the policy ceiling in a way, right, where we see that in the US, for example, where companies, are maybe not in a policy environment where they could perhaps react to certain engagement requests.
Thank you.
I was just going to say, I agree, too much disclosure is almost confusing for investors, isn't it? But it's not quite disclosure for disclosure's sake. I mean, often it's disclosing on how they are implementing these issues.
Yeah, it's like I said, it's important to
exactly
know what it's for and what it's going to achieve.
I probably need correcting on this, but I think the disappointing thing about the omnibus was not necessarily that it was a huge reduction in the amount of information, it was more a huge reduction in the number of companies that had to report, and I think maybe that was the wrong way around. I think maybe there should have been more of a level playing, focus on what should be being reported,
I agree with, because smaller companies might have more emissions, right, in certain spaces. It doesn't mean that if you're a smaller company, just smaller by employees, that you would have less emissions. So yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, and often they're part of the value chain of the larger companies anyway. So if the larger companies have to disclose this information, then they're going to need to know from the smaller companies.
Yeah,
so.
No, I fully agree. But just on policy, I wanted to also mention a good example is Japan. Japan doesn't even have a taxonomy. They set a really good example with that GX policy. So GX stands for Green Transformation Policy, and where they really took 22 industrial sectors and really looked at the transition pathways of each of those and really, you know, looked at how do they have to transition for Japan to really make progress on the decarbonization. And that is a really good policy example, I think.
That's a very positive way to end the discussion. It's just a minute or two to eight, and I want to make sure that we finish promptly and let all of you, including our generous stewards, go home. So it's been a real pleasure to chair this discussion. I hope you've all have found it as insightful and thought-provoking as I have. I think in a way it's very encouraging that we can have an event about climate solutions rather than just talking about climate problems, and to some extent it reveals the progress that we have made over recent years, if not enough, to deliver international climate goals. So please join me in thanking our speakers and panellists, Shafaq Ashraf, Dan Gardner, Simone Uttermark and Tessa Younger, for an excellent discussion this evening, and thank you all very much for joining us, both here at LSE and online. Have a very good evening.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.